supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. In 1958, Richard Loving and Mildred Dieter fell in love and got married in Washington, D.C. He was white, she was black. When they returned to their native Virginia, they were arrested and sentenced to 1 year in prison because they violated the state's ban against interracial marriage. The couple sued, and on June 12, 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor and overturned these discriminatory laws. Here's an excerpt from their oral argument.
Number 395, Richard Perry Loving, et al., appellants, versus Virginia.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justice, may it please the court. You have before you today what we consider the most odious of the segregation laws and the slavery laws. And our view of this law, and we hope to clearly show, is that this is slavery law. And the issue is, may a state proscribe a marriage between two adult consenting individuals because of their race? And this would take in much more in the Virginia statutes. Sections 2054 and 2057 void such marriages. These people, were they to go back to Virginia, and they are in Virginia now, will be subject to immediate arrest under the fornication statute and the lewd and lascivious cohabitation statute. And more than that, there are many, many other problems with these. Their children would be declared bastards under many Virginia decisions. They themselves would lose their rights for insurance, Social Security, for numerous other things to which they're entitled. So we strongly urge the court, in considering this, to consider this basic question. May the state proscribe a marriage between such individuals because of their race and their race alone?
Kind of eerie piece of sound, isn't it? We're talking about the Loving versus Virginia decision and its implication on today's show. We're talking about multiracial families in America. In a little while, we'll be joined by Kelly and Mark Kenny. They're both psychologists. They counsel multiracial families. But first, we'll hear about upcoming conference on this topic. Joining me now is Jungmiwa Bullock. She's the coordinator for the Loving Decision Conference 2007, and she's also president of the Association of Multi-Ethnic Americans. Jungmi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Oh, yeah, that was perfect. It's a multi-ethnic name, as you see.
And by the way, if you're interested in learning more about the Loving Conference, they are at www.lovingconference.com. Jungmi, I want to talk a little bit about what happened 40 years ago. We understand the law changed, but what were the implications of that change for couples?
Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of implications from that. I think one of the first things that it started, and what we're trying to continue at this conference, is a dialogue about how race has fractured this country and continues to do so. And it also developed a kind of a voice, a kind of spirit for multiracial families to be able to come forth and to pronounce their love publicly in a way in which they couldn't do prior to 1967. And at that time, also the children at that time began to come forth, not as much as they do come forth now because it's more public and more known. But there's been a lot of implications from that court case.
Well, we know, though, you talked about 40 years ago couples being able to declare their love publicly. We know from civil rights laws that changing laws don't change attitudes. So what happened to those new couples back then, 40 years ago, 35 years ago?
I'm not sure if I can speak directly on that. I mean, I can speak on behalf of my parents, you know, in that sense. Now, by me saying that they can pronounce their love publicly is different than saying that it was accepted, right? It's because it's still kind of a controversy that exists now. I guess I guess and more so the clarification is how have we or have we really moved forward since this 1967 decision? And although we've been more prominent and more vocal about families, here we have, 2007. We think about the implications of gay marriage in this country as well in relation to this court case, which can't always be synonymous, but that's another implication that this court case has raised today.
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, that was my comment about how eerie that piece of sound was. The American Association of Multi-Ethnic Family was started 20 years ago, 20 years after the decision. Why then? Who started it? And why does it exist?
It was co-founded by Carlos Fernandez and Ramona Douglas. Ramona Douglas actually just passed away 2 weeks ago. What happened is, there were a lot of families that existed way before that court case, right? There are many families that had tried to fight, but it just so happens that the Loving family had stepped forth and went all the way to the Supreme Court. And so the Association of Multi-Ethnic Americans developed after that because there have been a lot of multiracial groups that have started informally across the country. And now today, almost 20 years later, the Association of Multi-Ethnic Americans is still here. We are one of the oldest, largest advocacy organizations that promote the education and collaboration on behalf of multi-ethnic, multiracial, interracial families, and transracial adoptees.
Let me stop you there because there are two things that come out as I listen to you. Tell me why multi-ethnic families need an umbrella organization.
I guess our question is, why would they not? Because they do mark about, on the 2000 census, there are approximately, of those who self-identified, 7 million self-identified multiracial individuals. Now, that data, can be skewed here and there, but those are self-identified people. And that's in addition to 3 million interracial couples who self-identified on the 2000 census. And those numbers have only increased about 2% on the American Community Survey with the U.S. Census Bureau since then. So the population is growing exponentially. The college campuses have a multiracial group almost on every college campus. And the fact that AMIA is still around 20 years later is kind of a testament to say that, there is somebody out there supporting it
that's,
in some way.
That's what I mean. What kind of services are needed? What kind of interventions, programs, support?
Well, what really put AMIA on the map is the 2000 change. AMIA is most known for the organization, this nonprofit organization, to change the 2000 census, which was the first time in U.S. history to allow people to mark all that applied. So there was that classification issue, which really teeters into the education system about how parents can classify their children if they should need to do so.
Let me stop you there, because I want to know. This was a major issue getting that on the 2000 census.
Yes,
help us understand the implications of that. You also talked about parents and schools. Just tell us the implications of
for the 2000 census.
Yeah,
I think one of the major fears at that time was that there would be this multiracial category, whereas AMIA had promoted that we be counted amongst the traditional underrepresented communities as opposed to being dividing it, right? Because there's money and monetary figures placed on different communities within society. And so what we did was we promoted the fact that we would like to be counted among. So, for instance, somebody is a black and Korean, for instance, they would be counted amongst both those communities, but actually it really helped out the numbers within the African-American community, but controversially had taken away from some other areas, but that is still being up for debate in the U.S. Census Bureau that AMIA still occupies a seat with. And that has helped in that realm. And then also it's helped with ethnomedical data. Right now, multiracial children are disproportionately dying to leukemia because they don't have a bone marrow registry, because this country classifies people on the rubric of 5 to 6 traditional categories. And ethnomedical, the scientists there are saying that actually while race is socially constructed, at the same time, there's the life and death consequences, because multiracial children are more likely to get donors from other multiracial individuals. And because there is no bone marrow registry, they're dying disproportionately. And we are having a bone marrow registry at the conference for that.
Tell us about that. Tell us about the conference, Jeremy.
The conference, and first I want to thank you for at least having letting us have this outlet. We really appreciate it. The conference is happening in Chicago, Illinois. We had thought at first we would have it in Virginia, but because this is an international conference, people are coming in from all over the world, South Africa, Nepal, Spain, Ireland, interracial couples and multiracial people from all over. And this conference is really for everyone, and not just for people that were preaching to the choir. What we're really trying to do is incite a dialogue about the stemming from the Loving Decision Conference. I'm sorry, the Loving Decision. Because although many people from the outset can see that case as being more about marriage, it really had deeper implications about, I would say, the fear of miscegenation, the fear of how the children would come about, had many rooted issues with whiteness in this country, for instance. There's whole academic discourse on whiteness and privilege in this country, and that's a lot of the kind of controversial topics we'll be talking about at this conference, because everybody needs to come to the table. And I guess I would sum it up and best in saying that there's a book by David Parker and Mary Song, and the first thing they say is, the topic of mixed race brings out the best and worst in people. And I think that that's very, very telling in this country, because there's a lot of taboos still today by seeing interracial anything on television, let alone at a conference like this. And it's going to be very, very monumental.
Which brings up the question, you talk about there's still a lot of taboos.
Yeah.
And I read a poll recently that shows that 83% of Americans approve of interracial marriage, which really shocked me.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, there's been a great deal of progress over the last 40 years. So what's your vision of the next 40 years?
I would love to get that statistic. I would say that they're actually, but I would still question the statistics just a little bit. And I say this because what happens in a survey is different than what happens on the ground. Right? We get a lot of stuff across our table. A lot of stuff from hate groups, for instance, you know, like, can't believe you guys are, you know, promoting interracial marriages, et cetera. There's a lot of work that needs to happen on television. Recently, as you saw on the previous Super Bowl, there was an ad that was taken off the air, a commercial taken off the air, with a supposedly phenotypic white woman that came in, and there was a black man inside the locker room. And they completely took that off the air, and what that did is tell children whose parents look like that it wasn't acceptable in America's eyes to have that on television yet. While there are a lot of prominent multiracial figures and a lot of interracial couples and a lot of people transracially adopting, I think there is still a long way to go in order to talk about the deeper implications, like the ethnomedical issues, as well as classification, voting, et cetera.
Where do you see us 40 years from now?
I think that's one of the major questions we're asking. The second part of it's called the Loving Decision Conference 2007, the next 40 years of multiracial communities. And I think that's what we're really trying to bring forth at this conference. I would say in 40 years, I'm not sure if I can predict well, but I would say that I think that we will be if we're going at the rate we are going now, we probably will have a better discourse about how we can talk about race in a particular way, especially because multiracial youth are, again, growing exponentially in this country. And I think people are becoming more open-minded. I think as more visual and more prominent figures begin to speak up and don't feel questioned in the public eye, it will help out a great deal in 40 years from now.
Yeah, and my God, the younger generation is,
yes,
it's, you know, it's just automatic almost for
right,
the younger generation. It's just
right,
part of their lives.
Well, yeah, and there was one last thing there. Nia Peoples, actress Nia Peoples on Young and the Restless, is actually coming all the way out to Chicago in order to endorse and support and help us fundraise for student scholarship funds. So for the first time ever, a multiracial celebrity has ever come out to try to help out with something so very meaningful to children across this country.
That's fabulous. Let's hope more join them. There are lots of multiracial celebrities out there who could support this. Well, we've got to take a break and say goodbye to you. I want to thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you so much, Dan.
Wish you all the best at the conference. We were joined by Jungmiwa Bullock, and she is the coordinator for the Loving Decision Conference of 2007, and you can find that at lovingconference.com. When we come back, we'll be joined by Mark and Kelly Kenny. Kelly's a professor of counseling at Kutztown and a licensed counselor. Mark Kenny's an adjunct faculty trainer at the graduate program in Chestnut Hill. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Are you pregnant and depressed, looking for an alternative to medication? Penn has a research study to evaluate an investigational magnetic device for depression. If you aren't on antidepressants during your pregnancy and are 18 to 34 years old, you may qualify. All study evaluations and procedures will be provided at no cost by Penn doctors. To learn more, 215-662-2815. 215-662-2815.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2. 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the 40th anniversary of Loving versus Virginia today, the Supreme Court decision that legalized interracial marriages. Well, joining us now are Mark and Kelly Kenny. Kelly Kenny is a professor of counseling at Kutztown University. Mark is an adjunct faculty and trainer at the graduate program at Chestnut Hill College. Together, they have a training and consulting business called Rainbow Support Network. They do training and consulting around multiracial issues. Our phone number, if you want to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, let me welcome you one at a time. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And Mark?
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Hi to you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, let me start here with your website. Now, you know I am a trained observer, so when I looked at your website with my trained eye, I saw two things, that you are an interracial couple. I'm good, aren't I?
Yes.
And I also noticed that you're both over 25.
Yes.
Okay. So, tell that was tactful. So, tell us what the world was like when you began dating and decided to get married. What year was it, may I ask?
Let's see. We began dating in 1984, and actually this coming November, we will be celebrating 19 years of marriage. We've been together as a couple, again, since 1984. And
so tell us what it was like, Kelly.
Actually, in retrospect, it seemed pretty easy back then, but in retrospect, I'm realizing that perhaps I had rose-colored glasses on. You know, we were both young, fascinated with the world, in love, you know, two young adults in Philadelphia, and you know, young and carefree, and we were going to take on the world. And
well, let me start with you. Let me follow up, Kelly.
Yes.
Had you ever dated someone from another race?
I actually had. I had several people that I dated who were white, and I dated some other people as well. And actually, the one relationship ended on a sour note simply because of this issue. This was a person that I had dated for about two and a half years, and his family never even knew that we were a couple. Well, my family knew, and you know, he was frequented our house on a number of occasions, but it ended because he basically decided that, you know, he couldn't go through the relationship because it was too hard.
So, Mark, let me find out about your story. What was it like for you? Did you have rose-colored glasses also?
On one hand, yes. Again, as Kelly shared, I was living in Philadelphia at the time. I was 24. I was on my own as a teacher, working summer work at a private swim club in town, and I had lived in Center City for 6 years. So, you know, Center City then, as now, was a pretty progressive, open area of diversity and acceptance. And in that world, you know, everything was okay. At the same time, you know, coming from a white, suburban, middle-class family of the 60s and 70s, and having some prior interracial dating experience in which my parents expressed some concerns, and I'll just leave it at concerns about my dating, left me a little bit shy and reserved to share that beginning relationship with Kelly. So I was sort of in parallel worlds, where in one everything was fine, but at the same time, in the back of my mind, I knew that there was this other world. As this relationship became serious, that I was going to have to engage, along with an extended family of Irish and Italian North Jerseyites. So I had both going simultaneously.
When I looked at the Loving Day website and I read the personal stories, the theme that kept coming up was about each of their family of origins reaction to the marriage, to the relationship. It seemed almost like a major predictor in the success of a relationship. But first, I want to come back to you, Mark. Did your family change their mind? When and how?
Yes, they did change their mind. How was... I reached a point that this was going to be a serious relationship and a lifelong commitment, and made a decision to go on my own to New Jersey and sort of present this decision to my parents in the format of either you'll come with me or I'm going on alone. As presented at that point in time, they decided they were willing to go along. I should share briefly that my parents had their own inter-ethnic marital troubles in 1955, being of Irish and Sicilian heritage. So there was, you know, some distress around the challenges, potential difficulties that they needed to handle on their own and not put on myself. And then, surprisingly to me, because I had picked up messages from my extended family that there was, you know, some of the misinformation and stereotyping about African-American people, but was pleasantly surprised by my extended family on both sides to be very warm and welcoming to Kelly. And I distinctly remember my uncle, as the patriarch of the family, standing up at a family gathering, be it my grandmother's wake, Irish wake, and declaring that she was a Kenny, and if anybody had a problem or question, they'd have to deal with him. So from that point forward, Kelly has been very much a part of extended family, as well as our two daughters through our time together. So it has a happy ending, yes.
I am sure this early stage difficulty is not an unusual story. Kelly, what was it like for you entering a story, entering a family where you didn't feel fully accepted?
It was painful. It was hurtful.
Did you have second thoughts about whether you wanted to do this?
I think not second thoughts necessarily, as much as just anger and frustration. And I think there was a part of me that was wondering if there would be a point at which Mark would have to make a choice, and what choice would he make? And he made it very clear to me what choice he would make as he was leaving for that trip to have a conversation with his family. So I guess it was more hurtful, and not just hurtful for myself, but hurtful for my family. A very, middle class, educated, religious family background that I came from growing up in Philadelphia, and
it's
a nice person. Wouldn't they want me?
It's interesting when I hear the dynamics of this racist side. I feel like I'm back in my office where the son is put in a position where he has to choose between his mother and his wife, his family of origin and his wife. And, you know, the research shows that, you know, over-involvement with family of origin, specifically mothers, is the greatest negative influence on a marriage. Interesting. We're talking with Kelly and Mark Kenny. They are both counselors, and they specialize in interracial marriage, interracial couples, dating, multiracial families. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'll be back in about 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
Next time on Day to Day.
Disrespect immediately makes me think of my mother.
We're taught to respect each other.
It brings those thoughts of your mama being like, mm-mm.
That's right. But sometimes we struggle with words others may find offensive.
They can be funny. They can be liberating, depending on the company that you're keeping. R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
Find out what it means to me. Explore America's culture of disrespect.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about interracial families in light of the Loving decision 40 years ago, which banned laws against interracial marriage. My guests are Kelly Kenny and Mark Kenny. They are both counselors, and they have something called the Rainbow Support Network. It's a training and consulting business around multicultural issues, and their main area of specialty is multiracial families. Our phone number, 888-477-9499. Mark, I want to talk about the relationship itself. Interracial also means intercultural. The National Center for Health Statistics says that the chances of a mixed marriage breaking up in the first 10 years is 41% compared to 31% of couples of the same race. Why? What are the issues here?
Well, I think that I think there's twofold issues. When I think of interracial, I think of U.S. born couples, in which there's a unifying U.S. race cultural identity about meaning, about being of African heritage, being of European heritage, being of Latino heritage, being Asian American, that influences cultural worldview. The racism, and in heterosexual couples, certainly the sexism that gets caught up on those messages, because we do still are raised primarily in segregated areas. There's been an increase of social distance in terms of, in certain contexts, universities, the workplace, in which diverse worlds come together, but we bring those messages with us. So when I think of interracial marriages, I think one of the things that can be a stress and strain is one's self-awareness of one's own racial and cultural identity in a U.S. context. As a white partner, I have to be really clear about what the meaning of white privilege is. And being a white male, I also have to be conscious about the messages of patriarchy at the same time. So I think in white, other race combinations, I think those are some of the considerations. In same people of color relationships, let's say Latino and Asian or African American and Asian, in those cases, again, individuals may have misinformation about each other that they need to sort through, and if they don't, and create some sort of cultural empathy as a couple in the midst of this racist and sexist environment that still surrounds the messages that we get and misinformation, I think that can cause greater distress. When I think of intercultural couples, I think of couples in which maybe one partner is U.S. raised and the other partner maybe immigrant or not as enculturated in U.S. culture. And therefore, that can raise other dynamic issues around attitudes, values, and beliefs around, let's say, communication style, child-rearing practices, and if those things aren't communicated clearly and upfront, as in any relationship, if there isn't healthy communication and empathy for each other, as you're sorting through these differences, this, I think, will create trouble. I think the main thing as a therapist is to help couples focus on what brought them together and their strengths that brought them together as they deal with these other challenges of attitudes, values, and beliefs that they bring into the relationship.
Because if you're dating someone from another race or even marry someone from another race, it doesn't necessarily, we don't have our own stereotypes about that other race. But I'll tell you, when I try to put myself in that position, you know, I have trouble enough owning my own racism. You know, I know in the abstract sense it's there, but I have trouble owning it. And if I was dating an African-American woman, I'd have even more trouble owning it and seeing it and being honest with myself. How does that come out? How does that emerge in a way that's safe for both?
Mark?
Yeah, I think what for me is I have to clearly state up front all of my privileges and bring it to the consciousness in the forefront of my mind. And then I have to be fully listening to my partner's observations about myself and acknowledging where I might be working off my own myths and stereotypes. And at the same time, I think if it's done in a loving manner, I think if it's done in a manner of not in defensiveness, not in anger, but in a mutually respectful, loving manner in which my partner knows that I am being conscious of all the privileges that I have and that I am fully listening to her, that this allows her then for us to then have that communication. Because I still need to unlearn those very things.
And we all need to understand that stereotypes and racism and bigotry 99 times out of 100 are born of ignorance and anxiety.
Yes, exactly.
I want to talk about children. What are the issues with children? When you decided to have children, what did you struggle with? What did you need to deal with in advance?
How we were going to raise them in terms of understanding and celebrating, if you will, all the various aspects of their cultural identity. And that seems to be at the forefront of much of the research, much of the work that is done with regard to multiracial children, specifically the whole identity piece, is very important.
So how does that get worked through? We talked earlier about having multiracial on the census in 2000 being a very significant breakthrough with everyone's identity in the process. But do children, is the ideal, is the goal for children to be comfortable identifying themselves as multiracial?
Well, I think the goal is the ability for the individual to decide how they wish to identify, and that a multiracial identity is one of those choices that is healthy and can be viable. Historically, the government and political systems have dictated identity, either through physically eyeballing up into the 1960s of people's identities, and picking a monoracial identity and the racial identity of the quote in quotation marks lower social status identity. I think that there is no one answer to that. I think Dr. Maria Root and her ecological model has provided five healthy outcomes. And in her Bill of Rights of multiracial identity is the right of the individual to decide how it is they want to identify and the right to change their mind over the lifespan as they best see it. I think what has emerged is that this multiracial identity, embracing all of who you are, is a healthy outcome. It's not an identity of confusion or anything negative. One can embrace all of the ethnic identities that make you up and still be whole.
So that labeling yourself multiracial is simply a label, but the internal identification is much more complex and has much more depth than just that label.
Absolutely.
Dr. Maria Root feels that if you're going to choose an embracing of all your identities and if you want to be more of one identity than another in a given point in time, as long as your core values and beliefs of who you are as an individual stay intact, then you're not making an unhealthy choice as an individual.
We are talking today about multiracial families in the wake of the Loving decision 40 years ago. My guests are Kelly Kenny and Mark Kenny. They are an interracial couple, and they are both counselors and trainers. They have a consulting business called Rainbow Support Network. Our number is 888-477-9499. We have a couple of lines left open, so please call in if you've got a question. Again, that's 888-477-9499. And let's start with Jill. Jill, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My husband is from Wales, and I am American, and we adopted a little girl from Guatemala about 8 years ago. And when I told my parents, I'm Jewish, and when I told my parents that I was marrying a Welshman who was not Jewish, that was also an issue. However, mm-hmm. they got past it. When I decided to tell them I'm adopting a little girl from Guatemala, they said to me, please, don't let her be black. And I said to my mother, I don't care what color she is. She's going to be my child. This is it. Either, that's it. So after we got her, I remember when she was two, my father was holding my daughter in his arms, and we were just coming out of synagogue, and I heard him tell a story how my mother had two children, C-section back then in the 50s, and she could not have another one, and she wanted to adopt. And my father said no, he could not adopt a child that was not his. And then he's telling the story to somebody and saying, now that I have this baby in my arms, I love her so much. And this is a 75-year-old man changing the way he felt for probably his whole life. So things can happen and things can change at any time. Even though the young people are getting it now, the old people can still get it.
That's a wonderful story. How old is that 2-year-old baby now?
She's 8.
And how's she doing?
Oh, she's wonderful. She's a wonderful person. She's very special. She's in a great school, and she's just doing wonderful. She's happy in life, just keeps going. She's very determined, and she's a great child.
So I want to ask you, you know, we've been talking with Kelly and Mark about identity. Mm-hmm. She's pretty young. Have identity issues come up for her yet, and how have they been dealt with?
Yes, she's at a Waldorf school, so it's pretty open, but she has had other people comment about her skin color, because she is dark. And, you know, I mean, I tell her, look, everybody's got a different color skin. You know, I don't make a big issue of it. I don't bring it out like, you know, yes, your skin is this. I just, it's everybody has different color skin.
Hmm. Well,
and there is a biracial boy in her class as well.
Well,
a white mother and a black father.
Joy, so I appreciate the call, and I'm so glad to hear what happened with your dad for everybody involved. Take care. I want to talk about that issue with you, Mark and Kelly. When kids face racism, as inevitably they will in some way, shape, or form, what did you do with your kids? Did you prepare them?
We've always talked about race with our kids, even from the time that they were very young. I think we were sharing with Mike and how, you know, it started out with books that were on their level as small children, and has taken on more of a mature conversation as they get older. Our youngest is now 12, our oldest is now 15 and a half, but we've always been tried to be very open and upfront and honest with them. Our oldest daughter did have a very negative experience when she was 7, actually right here on my campus at a summer camp program.
What happened?
Where she was told by a little boy that brown people were a disgrace. And her initial response to that was to internalize it as there being a problem with her, that this meant that there was something wrong with her.
Which is not unusual.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so in dealing with it, Mark and I had to work with her around reframing that, you know, this wasn't about her, this, you know, didn't mean that she was a bad person or that anything was wrong with her, but that simply, you know, there are these feelings out there, and that a lot of people have trouble understanding what differences in skin color means and what it's all about, and the part of it is due to people's lack of information or misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had those kinds of conversations with our kids.
How do you have a conversation with a very, very young child about race? I mean, when did it start with your kids, and how do you do it?
Well, both children at around toddler age noticed that we were two different colors and clearly stated that. I remember my oldest child, probably a little bit older, maybe 4, announced to me in the kitchen that only her and mommy could go to Africa because they were black and I couldn't because I was white. So, you know, and
there's a discussion for you.
There you go. She leads a lot of discussions for us. We learn lots from her over the years. And right, that was a discussion starter. Just kind of laughing with her about it, and then kind of engaging her about, how is that? How come I can't go to Africa? That's very interesting. And just in a playful way, just engaging her on her thinking.
So how old was she when she picked that up?
Four.
Yeah, I'm 61 and made the same observation. Mm. So she might have a future as a trained observer also. let's go back to the phones. We got lots of people who want to join in. First, we'll go with Mei Ling. Mei Ling, hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I just wanted to mention, I'm glad that you're talking about this right now. I'm 36 years old, and I am quadricultural. My mother is African-American and Chinese. My dad is Native American and Irish.
Mm.
And I've been creating my own box on, like, census questions on applications or whatever. I make my own box called Other, or I check off practically every box on there. I've always felt alone in America as far as cultural unity because, I mean, we caught hell from every race. Mm. Kids used to say, oh, you're adopted when they saw our mom. It used to affect my brother a lot, but I was always proud of my multicultural heritage.
So I've got a question. I can't even find words, so bear with me here, Mei Ling. How do you experience yourself culturally?
Well,
do you still feel alone? Do you identify with many cultures or a combination of both?
Well, when I was a kid, the only culture I saw that looked kind of like us were Puerto Ricans. So I was like, I'm going to be Puerto Rican. And I changed my name around and I used to identify with Puerto Ricans, learned how to speak Spanish pretty much fluently. But now as I got older, I just like look for other racially mixed kids or adults, and it seems like you've met a long-lost friend when you see someone who's bicultural or quadricultural, and it just seems like you've met somebody that you've known for a long time just from being mixed, because we've all experienced the same aloneness, I guess.
Is there a quality of that aloneness that persists? Whether
a
it's
quality?
Yeah, that sense of aloneness, does that persist?
Well, I always wish that I could identify with, like, one culture. Like, I always, like, love to go to Italian-American affairs and things like that just to see them, how they get along with each other, and they have a culture to, I don't know, cull from, per se. So I miss that. But I'm proud of being mixed, and when people say, they do try to identify you themselves, like they'll say, oh, well, if you have a smidgen of black in you, then you're black. But if we were to go by birth certificates, then technically I'm Native American, because that's what my father's birth certificate says.
Well, it sounds like being, what do you call yourself, quadra-ethnic?
Quadricultural.
Quadricultural. you know, Mei Ling, it sounds like most things. There's brings with it good news and bad news. Thanks so much for your call, and
no problem.
Wish you the best.
We've
only got a couple minutes left, Kelly and Mark, and I want to talk about adoption issues, cross racial adoption issues. Besides parents educating themselves about their child's ethnic heritage, what else do they need to be aware of?
I think the importance of the response of the community, the response of other family members.
I wonder,
as was brought up in the one caller's example,
is cultural identity a developmental issue? I mean, does it become more important at a certain stage? Should parents not push the child's culture on them when they're too young? How does that work in terms of the child's growth?
I think it depends on the child. In communicating with the child, too, and working with the child's temperament around as they get older, how they want to negotiate. I think as a younger child, You're not going to raise that child fully in the cultural context of attitudes, beliefs, and values, because if you're two different cultural backgrounds, that's, you can't be another culture. But you can try to make the connection with other families, other children, like the child and like your family, or maybe put yourself in a situation in which you're the only one and your child is in the majority, for them to be exposed to see others and create their own sort of create their own identity, because they're not going to have whatever they physically look like have that identity fully and fully enculturated inside themselves. So, and I think then you follow the child's lead as they get older. Some children want more exposure. Other children decide that they're willing to acculturate with the parents' value system.
Obviously, you know, as Erickson and many of the other developmental theorists talk about the importance of identity in adolescence, identity takes on many different contexts at that point. So, you know, as Mark is saying, providing as much opportunity for exposure, being able to respond to questions, and basically so, meeting the child where he or she might be with regard to
well,
the whole notion.
So what I'm hearing is good parenting 101. Meet the child where they are, be able to be open, listen carefully, and respond to what's in front of you. We're out of time. Mark, Kelly, I want to thank you so much for joining us and for the work you do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
My guests have been Dr. Kelly Kenny, who's a professor of counseling at Kutztown. Mark Kenny is an adjunct faculty member at the graduate program in Chestnut Hill College. Earlier on, we heard from Jummi Bullock. She's president of the Association of Multi-Ethnic Americans and coordinator of the Loving Decision Conference of 2007. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. And if you want to reach me, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Shane Ewing is our intern. Christine Dempsey, well, she's our executive producer. Elisa Walters is our associate producer par excellence. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friend. Day to day.